Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is August 15th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. This is another SGEM Extra. Season number 4 will be starting soon in September, trying to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year, with critical appraisals of the recent literature. Until then, we have some more FOMED goodness from the Canadian Association of Emergency Physicians meeting that was held in Edmonton earlier this year. It was my pleasure to host the FOMED track at the CAPE meeting, and there were 4 amazing speakers lighting the way in Edmonton, including Lauren Westifer. Lauren is a social media superstar. She is currently the chief resident at Bay State Medical Center, Foamcast co-host with Jeremy Faust, author of the Shortcoat blog, and the Knowledge to Action Fellow. Lauren is passionate about free open access medical education, dissemination, and implementation science and metacognition. Lauren is the one that taught me how to say, y'all, is a FOMED powerhouse from down south, and she never foams it alone. The title of her presentation at CAPE was Unlearning in Medicine, Easing the Grieving Process with Foam. Here is the description Lauren gave of her talk. A Harvard Medical School's former dean proclaimed to his students half a century ago, quote, half of what we are going to teach you is wrong, and half of it is right. Our problem is we don't know which half is which. End of quote. So ease the denial, the anger, the sadness of hearing what you were taught is no longer accurate with foam. This isn't your favorite brew, rather free open access medical education, which can allow one to increase cognitive flexibility by staying up to date with evidence-based medicine and peer discussion. It's yoga for your brain. So that was the description Lauren gave of her talk. You can watch Lauren give her talk on YouTube and download a copy of her PDF slides, which will be available on the SGEM blog. As a Canadian, I will apologize for the audio quality of the recording because, you know, as Canadians, when we bump into furniture, we apologize. This was recorded in the lecture hall with my webcam microphone. So while the audio may not be the greatest, the content is fantastic. So here you have Lauren Westifer's talk at the CAPE meeting called Unlearning in Medicine, Easing the Grieving Process with Foam.
Hey, y'all. So kind of on Eve's Yoda quote, she mentioned unlearning, which was not planned, but that's the precise title of my talk. And the theme here at CAPE is Lighting the Way, Evidence-Based Medicine. So I wanted to show y'all one way in which we can use free open access medical education to help aid in that process of translating knowledge. So unlearning the foam force at work. These are my objectives in very boring font. I have no financial disclosures other than I'm an emergency medicine resident, but I have a pretty big bias that I wear fairly overtly. I believe in free open access medical education. It's what much of my knowledge and character as a physician is predicated upon. So just be aware that I blog, I podcast, I tweet, I believe in it. So everything I say is a little colored. In the bottom line of my talk, if y'all remember one thing or one slide, it's that unlearning, it's not this Death Star or this dark force. It's actually a very necessary part of knowledge translation and evidence-based medicine, but it's really, really hard and feels a little evil at times. But using free open access medical education makes this process a little easier and a little more natural. And we'll go through all of this now. So to really translate knowledge into action that reaches the patient, we not only have to learn, and we learn so much, we learn all the time in medical school, every little fact, that so much that we have to look it up on our iPhones, but we also have to unlearn, and we're really not taught anything about that. And so to demonstrate why, I'm gonna share with y'all a really personal story. It's a story of tragedy and heartbreak that goes back to my childhood. And it's the day that I learned that Pluto was no longer a planet. So my whole life, Pluto anchored the far end of the Milky Way. It was that constant in the solar system. It was a part of every mnemonic. I was ready to graduate from college, and all of a sudden, Pluto, no longer a planet. I felt kind of robbed in latitude, to be honest. I had to relearn everything. All the mnemonics, the entire solar system felt a little topsy-turvy. But it's not just planets, and it's not just space. There's plenty of heartbreak in medicine. So my first month of medical school, we were certified in the alphabet of resuscitation, advanced cardiac life support. Do y'all have that up here? Just kidding.
Well, thank you, Marge, for this wonderful time.
So we were taught the ABCs. A patient codes, is bowed down, you check their pulse, you check their breathing. It's the ABCs, airway, breathing, resuscitation. So fun. The laryngoscopes, everyone loves those. Except we had it backwards. The alphabet that I learned that first month of medical school, a couple months later, was overturned in the guidelines. Compressions, airway, breathing. C-A-B, the alphabet, was turned upside down. Already, I was just into medical school and I had to unlearn the alphabet. It seemed overwhelming. Now CPR. Now this. Is this cath lab activation material? Is this a STEMI? So I learned that newer presumed new left lumbar branch block cath lab activation, a STEMI equivalent. Well, in 2013, our American Heart Association guidelines said, actually, we were just joking. Don't activate the cath lab. So again, I had to unlearn. But this is resuscitation literature. That changes all the time. It's so sexy. We never know what to do day to day. What about something simple like laceration repair? Now, I, like Eve, hurt myself fairly frequently growing up with two brothers. So one day doing something I probably shouldn't have, I sliced open my finger, and my mom, a family practitioner, repaired my finger at the table, and she brought out our amped up first aid kit with all these bottles, and instead of turning the conversation into the repercussions of doing something that I wasn't supposed to do in my punishment, I directed the attention to something she liked, which was medicine. So I asked about the various bottles, and Lida came with Epi. I was like, Mom, why are we using this one? No lidocaine with Epi in the fingers, nose, penis, toes. Now, I repeated that very frequently for the next couple weeks because, not because I got to say words that otherwise were inappropriate, but because it was just interesting, it was catchy, and I could show my medical knowledge at the age of 9. I've always been very proud of myself. But in medical school, the same thing, I would get pimped whenever we would repair a laceration during my fourth year of medical school. They would say, now, student doctor, where would you not use lidocaine with epinephrine? Well, sir, fingers, nose, penis, toes, no lidocaine with epinephrine. I was listening to a podcast one day, and I found out that this isn't even based on scientific fact. It's a misunderstanding from the 1940s that involved boric acid. So I had to tell my mom that she taught me wrong. But we both had to go through this unlearning process, and not just CPR, but very fundamental things. It seemed like flipping a coin. Anything that I learned, it was sort of heads or tails, whether it would actually be true or not. And this is just a small smattering of things that I've had to unlearn: ketamine, safety and head injury, the degree of cooling and therapeutic hypothermia. And I'm just finishing my second year of residency. I've had to unlearn a lot. It seems like those things. And I wish somebody had told me. A dean at Harvard's medical school did tell people once, he said, hey, 50% of what we're gonna tell y'all is right, 50% is wrong. The problem is we don't know which half is which yet. But nobody conditions us that we will have to unlearn things. They just tell us, you'll always have to learn, always have to learn. 50% seems a little aggressive, I think. I didn't really believe that number. It sounds catchy though, it's very catchy. But there's some literature behind this. Ibrahim and colleagues in JAMA in 2014 looked at randomized controlled trial data, and they looked at reanalysis of that data. So people that had, they took this data and put it through a different statistical machine, and they found that about 35% of the time, a different group should be treated or not treated. So a third of the time, we were doing things inappropriately or wrong, had to unlearn some things. And that's with the same data, just a different statistical process. And then Prasad and colleagues, again, looked at 10 years worth of New England Journal trial data. They looked at 1,344 articles that tested a standard care practice and either against a new intervention or see if they could reproduce it. I think that's a thing that we're supposed to do in science, is be able to reproduce things. And they found out, again, 40.2% of the time, the standard of care practice was reversed. So a learning is necessary because there is medical reversal. Things that we once think are true are no longer true, either when somebody, goes through the data or when newer, different interventions come about. Now, who here thinks unlearning and learning are the same thing? Anyone unconvinced? No, or nobody bold enough to tell me. So I want y'all to do something real quick, because I think unlearning and learning. All right, take your hands like this. All right, now clasp them together like this. Which finger's on top? Anyone right on top? Okay, my right is on top. Now take them again and go the opposite way, opposite finger on top. It's like awkward, and the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. So I think about that like learning and unlearning. One is easy, it's comfortable, we do it without even thinking. The other one, it's like out of our comfort zone and it's awkward and we have to think about it. Now if you sit there and you practice it, it becomes more and more natural feeling, but in a day when you do it, it's gonna feel really weird if you don't stay on top of it, if you're not conditioned to accept it. So unlearning is necessary, but it's hard. And not only is it hard because it puts us out of our comfort zone, it's also hard because we take medical knowledge personally. If we're told that something that we think or practice is wrong, that we need to unlearn it, it feels like we are being assaulted. We take it very, very personally. Maybe it's our pride, perhaps it's our passion, perhaps it's the years that we spent learning, but we take it personally like this. It was tragic. I died inside. Now, this is Dr. Eve Purdy when she was reflecting on her unlearning process for one of mankind's greatest losses. And here, what was it?
Pluto.
The loss of Pluto. So, but again, we take it personally when our knowledge, when we have to unlearn something. And here's why. I think that it's because the unlearning process mirrors the Kubler-Ross cycle of grief. So we're shocked. We just don't believe it. And then we just deny it, pretend it doesn't exist. Maybe we get a little angry. We get depressed. And maybe if we're lucky or smart or unlearned or just, really intent, we can actually accept something. And this is the process of unlearning. And I'm going through this because this is where I think free open access medical education helps prevent this cycle from even getting started or can intervene. And so first, we deny things. We pretend we can't see, hear it. We pretend it doesn't exist. We either don't look at the studies, we never encounter them, or we just don't listen, like the little kid where they just, I can't hear it. Or we may even go so far, like lidocaine with epinephrine, we don't even stock it in the hospital. I don't know about these studies saying it's useful in fingers. We just don't even have it. And then we take that apathy and indifference and we trade it for boxing gloves. We become aggressive and defensive. We're put on the defensive. And we may get angry. We may say, Dr. Westover, do you want to necrose their fingers? Do you want them to fall off? Maybe we should just chop off their fingers instead of injecting lidocaine with epi for that digital block. We get very defensive of the knowledge that we have. And again, it's a reflection of how personally we take this. It inhibits our unlearning. Then we can become depressed. So we have to unlearn so many different things. Perhaps it's not even worth it. Why get involved in all this evidence-based medicine nonsense if none of it's going to be true anyways, or maybe I need to relearn it and unlearn it and relearn it? Seems like quite a bit of a cycle, a lot of effort. None of it's worth it. I've been practicing medicine for this long, and I haven't killed too many people yet. 2 years. I've been practicing medicine for 2 years. But again, this really inhibits the uptake of evidence-based medicine and medicine. Now, maybe, just maybe if we're lucky, and we find a way to navigate through that whole cycle, or we have things that can help guide us through, we can accept something. We can accept a new piece of evidence or some suggestions and integrate it into the way that we practice medicine so it becomes more comfortable. Like we're practicing crossing our hands both ways so that we're mentally and cognitively flexible in our practice. So maybe now I've convinced you that unlearning is necessary, but it's also hard. It's personal and it's kind of like this dark force at work, undermining the translation of knowledge and best practice. But there are some solutions, and I think that it's easier and more natural with free open access medical education. This is the phone track, I suppose. And this is one of the biggest ways in which free open access medical education, for me, has really helped me from even entering that cycle of grief. that really makes unlearning natural so that I don't even think about it. And it's early exposure. Not early adoption, but early exposure. Because when we get a piece of information early on, it's not so offensive when presented later. Even if we don't adopt it, if we've heard it, it's like a language when somebody's young. If you've heard it, you can recognize it and see if something is familiar. So we may not go on the defensive. We may not get aggressive. We may still go to the denial phase, but it prevents us from getting angry or defensive. And free open access medical education does this in ways. I featured Twitter here because on Twitter there are always new ideas coming out, new articles that are in press that haven't even been released, or people sharing concepts that again are not widespread. So we're exposed to this early on in our careers. It may make us a little more cognitively flexible. Also through repeated exposure. Now, in free open access medical education world, it's kind of accused oftentimes of being a little incestuous or repetitive, focusing and perseverating on certain topics, resuscitation or domnolysis, these very sexy topics. But one benefit of this is that different people will cover the same topic repeatedly. So oftentimes I feel like I'm being beaten over the head by something and I just can't ignore it anymore. So even if I'm in denial, I'm beaten out of it with repeated exposure. And educators call this by a fancy term that is actually one of the most evidence-based means of learning, which they call it spaced repetition. In the South, we stick with being beaten over the head. But free open access medical education is really good. And the community aspect shouldn't be overlooked as well, because isolation is one thing that inhibits, I think, knowledge translation. We may practice in these silos where researchers are really, they spend their whole lives working on one focus. So in order to unlearn it or talk about unlearning something in that area, it's like blasphemy. Or I spent some time in a rural location where there just wasn't a big influx of new thought. There wasn't a community there that was really focused on adopting or thinking about new ways of doing things or even keeping up with the most recent guidelines. But with the phone community, things like Twitter, or even comments on blogs, it networks you into a larger world where you can be kind of, it's intellectual voyeurism. You can see what other people are thinking and reading and seeing, and again, getting the early exposure. But it's also a way to sort of vet ideas. Hey, people are talking about this new intervention. What do you think? We're not doing that here. And you can really tap into the larger community. Now I'm gonna share with y'all, actually, I'm not. I changed the order of my slides. My apologies. Another way in which free open access medical education harnesses the ease of unlearning is through the volume. Now, there's tons of foam out there, but there's even more scientific knowledge. It's estimated that it doubles every 3 to 5 years. I tried to look into the exact data behind that, and it's kind of sketchy, but it apparently used to be about 19 years. Now it's about 3 to 5 years. Either way, there's so much medical knowledge out there, we can't possibly get through it all. And free open access medical education curates and provides us with that knowledge a little more quickly, again, for the early and repeated exposure. And some resources I find really helpful for this, particularly with translating knowledge, is research and reviews in the Fastlane from Life in the Fastlane. 5 to 10 articles a week from about 25 to 50 different journals with short synopsis. And the great thing here is that they cover not only the game changers, the practice changing articles, but also the rubbish. Like, you should really be aware of this trash. People may talk about it. But it's really interesting because it delivers it, pushes it to your blog reader or RSS feed in a way that you don't have to go out searching, but also you don't have to read the 25 different journal articles. Emergency Medicine Literature of Note, Dr. Ryan Rudesky, does a similar thing, reviewing a journal article every single day. So again, he is taking these articles that are coming out that may potentially be game-changing, may be trash, but providing it to the user so that in a digestible, very quick format, you can look, see whether it's an article you want to read or not, to help get through that volume of information. And then there's Dr. Rory Spiegel's EM Nerd. Now his tagline there, Nihilism, Medicine, and the Art of Doing Nothing, kind of goes along with the unlearning thing. He really has a very poignant and eloquent way of teaching us that we should really be unlearning much of what we do in medicine because much of it does not work. And an interesting thing here is that he has even tackled some of the dogma that's been perpetuated in the free open access medical education world. So there too, we need to be aware that we need to unlearn things that we learn in the phone world. Now time. Time is like one of the greatest disruptors in the force. How many of y'all have time for all the projects that you want? Right? We're just doctors. That's all we do, right? We're not mothers or fathers or husbands or educators or mentors or community people, handymen, rugby players. No, we have so many different roles. And when you have to read 20 to 200 articles to get one that's useful for you, there's no way we can possibly do that effectively. And that's where podcasts come into play too. Again, giving us early and repeated exposure to things that we otherwise would never be able to get to. And they allow us to do so when we're seemingly engaged in other activities that aren't necessarily cognitively strenuous. Going to the gym, working out, cooking dinner, walking our dogs, things like that. And there are a couple here that I wanted to mention, the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. I'm actually not just saying this because Ken is here. It's one that has taught me a lot of practices that I value, I may need to unlearn or at least question them. Emergency medicine cases, also very good. SmartEN, for me, it's not a prolific podcast, but it is the pinnacle of unlearning. It reminds me of, I think, if you combine unlearning about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and Pluto and everything in medicine all in one day, that's like an episode of SmartEN, questioning the very fundamentals of what I've learned in my brief time as a physician. And then there's Hefty MCAST. It's a new one from the UK, but again, talks about the integration of new articles into practice and whether they do or do not fit, which I think is a very pragmatic approach and also very interesting. But these are just a few of my favorites, which help precondition me in the event that I do need to unlearn, so I'm always at sort of a ready state and at least open and cognitively flexible to new information or ways of seeing things. So here's an example, a phone helping me unlearn in a way in which it changed my practice at a bedside with a specific patient that I can still see her face in my mind. So it goes from 2012 to 2014. I saw a blog post as a fourth year medical student that I was sort of like, this is sort of a fringe thing. And then it was repeated and I was like, maybe I should pay attention. And then guidelines came out and I really enjoy staying up to date with things. So I paid attention to that. And then I was actually taught it formally incorrectly. I had unlearned it and was told I needed to relearn it. And then I got some repeated exposure on Twitter, and eventually I practiced it at the bedside. So we'll go through each of these. In July of 2012, I was a fourth year medical student working out at the gym, and I was scrolling through my blogs and came across a free blog at that time. It was Dr. Alma Matu's EKG of the Week. It happened to be a left bundle branch blog, and so I was going through, and it said, no, it's not an acute myocardial infarction, don't activate the cath lab. Now, at that time in the United States, the protocol still said activate the cath lab if it's a new or presumed new left bundle branch block. So y'all probably stopped doing this about 10 years ago, but I think we lagged a little bit. But I thought maybe that's a fringe, this is a guy on the fringe, I don't know this Alma Matu guy. But then I got to repeated exposure. So then I got to repeated exposure in December of 2012. This blog that I follow, again, it was pushed to my RSS reader, and I was reading through it, and it said, nonchalantly, by the way, we've been telling you this for many years, but now the guidelines are adopting it, new or presumed new left bundle branch block, don't activate the cath lab. So it forecasted the coming of the guidelines, preconditioning me that I needed to unlearn, but also repeated that previous exposure, solidifying it in my head so that I could recall it a little more easily. Then I sat down, I was a newly minted doctor, it was my second week of orientation as an emergency medicine resident, and we were sitting in ACLS, Advanced Cardiac Life Support, and we got to acute coronary syndrome, and here I saw it, new left bundle branch block, cath lab activation. And I was like, no, and I couldn't help myself. A friend took a picture of it because they were impressed by my passion in writing out the citations for the articles that supported it. But again, I had already unlearned it and I was just reinforcing it here, but the guidelines and the coursework work had not caught up yet. And then I got some repeat exposure, again on Twitter, Dr. Alma Matu, again reminding me, the guidelines even say it, I know you were just put through this ACLS course, but you were presumed new left bundle branch block, don't activate the cath lab, please. And then here's the community aspect. It turns out the European guidelines, again, had not caught up. They retained a new left bundle branch block should be cath lab activation material. So people that maybe were practicing in other practice settings where they needed to activate the cath lab, this is sort of a forecast that they may need to unlearn a practice to make it easier. It's like practicing doing the opposite hand crossing over so that when the time comes, you can do it a little more easily. I was in my first month in the ED as an intern, and everyone in my attending and the other residents were involved in this prolonged resuscitation, and they said, hey, we've got a code stimming coming in. They just called it in. Do you want to activate the cath lab doctor? And I said, that's intern. Interns. I'm not even comfortable saying Dr. Westenberg. And it was this. And again, it's a left bottom branch block with lots of voltage, but it doesn't meet Scarbosa criteria. But the protocol for EMS was activate the cath lab, call a code stimming. And I said, hold on, wait, let me just like see the patient, time out. Let's at least wait until I can call an attending over here. I went and saw the patient. She had some nausea, she had had some vomiting. She wasn't in Florida heart failure or anything like that. So with her, I was able to take a proper history without sending her to the cath lab first and diagnose her cholecystitis. I think she was a little thankful for that. She did not need cath lab activation. But the setting, the mentality that I've been conditioned to and the entire system was set up for was send this lady to the cath lab based off of the EKG. So I was able to take what I had learned through free open access medical education and kind of seamlessly adopt it, although initially I was a little reticent at first. But there are some pitfalls to be aware of using phone this way. So first of all, there's selection bias. There's a very, we only may see the things that we seek out, and we only seek out certain pieces of information. We may not be exposed to other things. We may not encounter things that we actually do need to unlearn or learn. It can also be a bit of an echo chamber of sorts. So we may be keep hearing the same thing, our views or the reaffirmations of what we think. So things that we may think we need to unlearn or learn, maybe just echoing back to us. So it's just something to keep in mind about maintaining the cognitive flexibility, being open to things, especially even within the free open access medical education world. And then there's premature adoption. Early adoption and early exposure isn't the same as adopting things before the evidence actually comes out, before it's been vetted. So these are just some pitfalls that I see fairly frequently. So unlearning, I think it's a pillar that holds up the ability to practice evidence-based care. It's necessary, and it's hard, and it doesn't come naturally. But I think that there are ways in which we can make it easier with things like free open access medical education or other means that help us become imprinted or cognitively flexible, ways in which we can be ready to unlearn when the time comes, when information is presented to us. And so I hope that y'all are all ready to not only learn, but also unlearn. That is the end of my talk.
So there you have it, Lauren Westover's talk at the CAPE meeting called Unlearning in Medicine, Easing the Grieving Process with Foam. The SGEM is on Facebook, so if you'll please like our page, that would be great. You can follow the SGEM on Twitter at the SGEM. And if you would please take a few seconds to give the SGEM a rating on iTunes. There was a Keener Contest winner last week from Chris Carpenter's guest hosting episode on preventing older adult falls from the emergency department. Mike Butterfield from Tampa, Florida won a cool skeptical prize. He knew The Hurricane was a biopic movie about Reuben Hurricane Carter, starring Denzel Washington, and was filmed in Paterson, New Jersey. Well, that is all for today, but don't panic. The SGEM will be back in September with more critical reviews, hot off the press, SGEM classics, and SGEM journal clubs. Until then, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.